This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
The latest desecration of the Holy Quran in Sweden and Denmark continues to spark condemnations and protests. Tens of thousands of Israelis marched from Tel Aviv to Al-Quds. Protests PM Netanyahu's judicial overhaul plan that would curtail Israeli top court's powers. And in Peru, police clashed protesters holding new anti-government rallies in the capital, Lima. Thanks for joining us. The leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution has categorically condemned the desecration of the Holy Quran in Sweden. Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei said the sacrilegious act was a bitter, conspiratorial, and dangerous move. The leader said all top religious figures in the Muslim world agreed that the most severe punishments should be handed down to the perpetrator of this profane act. He noted that the Swedish government's support for the culprit amounts to a battle array for war against the Islamic world. Ayatollah Khamenei added that Stockholm has a duty to hand over the perpetrator to the judicial bodies of Muslim countries. President Ibrahim Raisi also echoed the leader's remarks. He denounced the sacrilege as a criminal act. The leader of Lebanon's Hezbollah movement warns Sweden that continued support for the desecration of the Holy Quran in the country would amount to a declaration of war against the Muslim world. Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah called on Arab and Muslim countries to cut their diplomatic and economic ties with Sweden. Nasrallah said the Swedish government's mere condemnation is not enough. He hailed Iraq and Iran responses to the desecration of the Quran, calling on Muslim states to follow suit. Iraq has expelled the Swedish ambassador, and Iran has refused to admit a new Swedish envoy to the country. People have gathered in front of the Swedish embassy in the British capital to voice their anger at the desecration of the Quran in Stockholm.
We see the act of burning of the Quran as Islamophobic. And it's a red line. It's a red line which we don't allow to be crossed. It's the words of Allah. And in no way, shape or form will we allow this to happen without condemning such acts. When it comes to other groups, other religions, freedom of speech doesn't exist. There's anti-Semitism, there's racism, but when it comes to Muslims, it all comes under the banner of freedom of speech. They obviously see the religion as a threat.
I wouldn't call that freedom of speech. Even in their own law, they have no right to insult other people's belief, particularly the holy book. In this holy book, even the Jew and Muslim, Jew and Christian, are upset about it because the name of the Moses and Jesus are in our book. It just refers to all of them.
It causes divisions and tensions and, in fact, violence. In some nations, this could even be seen as an act of war. You're attacking the holy book, which is more than 1,400 years old, which gives us rights. This book gave human rights that were only given in the past 8 years in this country. So, in fact, this should be the Constitution for the United Nations. But they don't see the value in this book. So all we ask them is respect our feelings, respect our beliefs.
People in the Iraqi capital Baghdad have held a new demonstration against the desecrations of the Quran in Sweden and in Denmark. Protesters gathered outside of Baghdad's Green Zone, housing foreign embassies. Earlier on Saturday, Iraqi security forces dispersed hundreds of protesters who tried to enter the fortified area. The Danish Refugee Council office in Iraq's southern city of Basra has reportedly been attacked by protesters. On Thursday, protesters set fire to parts of the Swedish embassy. Denmark, on Friday, was the scene of another sacrilegious act. Two similar acts of desecration of the Holy Quran also occurred in Sweden over the past month. Simadasta Rizvi, executive member of the Assembly of Scholars of Jammu and Kashmir, joins us. Welcome to the program. When you take a look back at the history of anti-Muslim actions, the burning of the Quran or the desecration of the Holy Book has been one of the acts that's been committed. But it seems like this occurrence is repeated by, well, it seems like Western countries are at the forefront of this. And in this case, we're looking at Sweden being that country. Why is it that Western countries feel that this needs to be committed every so often? What does that say, especially when it comes to the way that they're viewing Islam and Muslims and then in turn the Holy Book?
Thank you. First of all, I say my condemnation for the devilish insult of Holy Quran by Salwan Momika, who has over this time twice committed this insult towards the sacred book of Islam. It is the same trend of Islamophobia, which in the West these people are creating chaos regarding the teachings of Islam. But we must understand that it is not for the first time that they are insulting and discrediting Holy Quran. They have done it over the last few years. You see, in 2020, there was that Rasmus Paludan, that Jewish student, who openly burned Quran and torn the face of Holy Quran. Now, it is not an incident. We have to understand that it is not only an incident, but they are trying to set a trend towards enmity of Islam. That is more dangerous for Muslim Ummah, Muslim nation, and all over the Muslim people. You see, when you create this set of trends, all the people if you are not going to stop this, if government is not stopping this, if Muslim Ummah is not coming forward, then this will be a trend in the West, in the other countries, and they will continue this trend. You see, this time, social media is easily seen all over the world. Now, this is not only an incident. They are planningly doing it in Islamophobia manner and trying to set a trend to create more enmity towards Islam. Muslim Ummah and Muslim nations have to come forward to break this trend. It's very important. Otherwise, this will continue and create more chaos and more enmity between religions. It is not only person. It is a trend going to be enmity between the Muslims and other religious people. So we have to break this. We have to live in harmony between all the religions. But you cannot live in harmony if you are going to hurt the sentiment, hurt the basic fundamentals of any religion. You can't live in peace if you are insulting other nations and other religions. So it is important for Muslims to come forward collectively to break this trend so that world liberty.
Thank you very much. We do appreciate that. And thank you for your contribution. That is Sayyid Mudassir Rizvi, executive member of the Assembly of Scholars of Jammu and Kashmir. Moving on, tens of thousands of Israelis have marched from Tel Aviv to Al-Quds to protest Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's judicial overhaul just 2 days before a critical vote on the issue. The rally is being held for the 29th straight week. Protesters called for scrapping the bill, which they say will weaken the Israeli High Court's ability to review cabinet decisions. They promised to camp outside of the Knesset. Similar rallies are also being held in other towns and cities across Israel. The Knesset will hold a final vote on the matter on Monday. The bill will roll back some of the Supreme Court's powers and give the ruling coalition decisive sway in picking judges. Critics say the legislation will open the door to corruption and abuses of power. Barry Grossman is an international lawyer who joins us from Bali, Indonesia. Obviously, these protests is quite remarkable in the sense that they've continued consecutively for the length of time that they have had. And some are looking at these protests beyond just these so-called judicial reforms, where you're looking at Israelis who are really angry about the cost of living. Do you think that perhaps is one of the central issues that they're experiencing there Amongst many, you add to that the political instability and, of course, the insecurity that they feel due to the policies that have been enacted by this extreme cabinet. How do you see these protests?
Well, look, in general terms, we're seeing protests around the world against what is being characterized as authoritarianism. And certainly these proposed amendments, which would not only give the incumbent government's party final say over judicial appointments, but would let them override Supreme Court decisions, is something that it ought not to be surprising that liberals, if there is such a thing as Zionist liberals, would get up in arms about. But at the end of the day, none of this is any great surprise. There's nothing democratic about this occupying force and the way it governs. There's nothing in this which really is of any interest to those of us who support the Palestinian cause. And ironically, if anything, this move by Netanyahu's government, who, remember, managed to get put on hold corruption charges against him as he retook office again. The irony is that this is helpful to the Palestinian cause in that one of the things international courts look at where war crimes are being tried and the like, violations of international law, is whether the government in the place where the allegations are being made has pursued all avenues of investigation and prosecution. And now that we're seeing that Netanyahu is taking issue even with the notion of separation of powers, that is, the separation of the executive and legislative branch and the judicial branch, it makes it all that much more difficult for the Israelis to argue that if there are any excesses, they're dealing with them in their own way and they're doing so properly. But at the end of the day, there's, of course, nothing in Israel's judicial structure now which is in any way sympathetic to the Palestinian cause. To be sure, if these changes go ahead, as we expect they will, it won't become any better and is likely to become worse. But ironically, if there's anything in this that's of interest to those of us who stand with the Palestinian cause, it's that it detracts from any ability on the Israelis' part to argue in front of an appropriate tribunal that Israel is doing what it can to investigate and prosecute excesses as it continues to wage an illegitimate, belligerent war against Palestinians.
Well, the Palestinian cause obviously is very important when it comes to especially this extreme cabinet. I mean, obviously, they're probably facing one of the challenges that they didn't foresee in terms of the way that these protests have occurred. But are we looking at something that's even beyond that? And that is the fact that you're looking at Israel actually rupturing, not only from within, but also from the outside factors being the way that the resistance groups and Palestinians are putting up a huge fight to counter them. But, you know, you have even Israelis like the former politician Ehud Barak, who said that Israel may not see its 80th anniversary. Are we looking at a situation that Israel is facing in that, I guess, arena?
Well, to be clear, I certainly don't see these protests as being in any way significantly motivated by a concern for Palestinians or by a concern that Palestinians are treated better by the occupation. This is similar to what we're seeing around the world. People are protesting with the sense that governments are not paying attention to them, that governments are making it more and more difficult for them to earn a living, and governments are creating a blanket of uncertainty when it comes to economic and other considerations that is driving people from all shades of the political rainbow to take issue, be concerned, and protest. But these protests, in other words, are motivated by a concern with self-interest. And that's why I say there's nothing really in it for Palestinians. Certainly, the occupation's judicial structure, as it currently is, even before these amendments, has never shown itself to be in any way sympathetic to Palestinians or the Palestinian cause, or to be in any significant way critical of excesses by the Israeli Defense Forces. And to be sure, these protests that we're seeing are pretty much entirely motivated by Zionists being concerned personally about their own personal interests in the face of these changes.
Barry Grossman, thank you so much. International lawyer there from Bali, Indonesia. Thanks. Moving on, a new round of anti-government protests intensifies in Peru as police and demonstrators clash in the capital, Lima. Protesters are demanding the removal of President Dina Boluarte. They also want early elections, a new constitution, and the dissolution of the right-wing Congress. The fresh wave of demonstrations began earlier this week after a few months of relative calm. Protests were initially sparked last December following the ousting of Peru's former president, Pedro Castillo. Demonstrators say Boluarte and her allies illegitimately removed and jailed Castillo. Nearly 70 people have been killed in the worst social unrest to hit the country in two decades. Human rights groups accuse security forces of excessive abuse and extrajudicial killings in the violent clashes. Spaniards are going to the polling stations in crucial general elections that could swing Eurozone's fourth-largest economy to the populist right. More than 37 million people are eligible to cast their ballots. Socialist Pedro Sanchez has been prime minister since the year 2018. He's hoping that his government's reforms, crisis management, and handling of a strongly performing economy persuade voters to keep him in office. But his party has been lagging in polls behind the Conservative People's Party, led by Alberto Núñez Feijóo. The conservative leader wants to roll back many of the socialist reforms. Opinion polls show the election will likely produce a win for Feijóo, but to form a government, he will need to partner with the far-right Vox. The Russian Ministry of Defense says its forces have killed a large number of Polish and German mercenaries stationed in western Ukraine.
According to confirmed information on July the 6th, as a result of a group strike with long-range sea-launched high-precision weapons on the territory of the Ukrainian Armed Ground Forces Academy in the city of Lviv, a large number of Polish and German mercenaries stationed there were eliminated.
The identities and exact numbers of those killed were not disclosed. The ministry further noted nearly 5,000 foreign mercenaries fighting against Russian forces have been eliminated since the start of the war in Ukraine, and the same number has fled the combat zone. Back in March, it was reported that around 20,000 internationals, mostly coming from European countries, traveled to fight Russia in Ukraine. This comes alongside the 16,000 foreign mercenaries, including Israelis, whom Zelensky announced would be fighting in Ukraine. This is while some of Ukraine's European allies, including Britain, did not approve of sending so-called volunteers to the war. Thousands of protesters in Bangladesh have taken to the streets of Dhaka to demand the resignation of Prime Minister Sheikh Hasina and his ruling Awami League Party. Protesters demanded a caretaker government take office and organize free and fair elections. In the rally, Bangladesh Nationalist Party leaders announced boycotting the elections in January of next year. Opposition parties have accused the government of rigging past national elections. However, the incumbent Prime Minister Hasina has denied the allegations. In recent weeks, tens of thousands have held rallies, some of which turned violent against the ruling party across the country. Earlier this week, at least one protester died and over 50 were injured in clashes with police in the capital. And that is for this edition of World News. It's bye-bye for now.
Take pieces of bread from me. and your soul will never be broken. And if I am your haven, you will never be homeless. One whose cloak is me will never be naked. And one whose resort is me will never be destitute. God is above all powers. IRIB English Radio.
Listeners Special. In the name of God, the All-Compassionate, the All-Merciful. Salam, dear listeners, and warm greetings to you all. Welcome to another edition of Listeners Special on this Sunday, July 23rd, 2023. I'm Atef Erfani, hosting this program today. And on behalf of all IRIB English Radio staff, I extend my deepest condolences to you on the arrival of the month of Muharram, the month of the martyrdom of the Master of Martyrs, Imam Hussein, peace upon him. Listeners Special is the Sunday program where your views are presented through your emails, your letters, and your messages. So please contact us and tell us what you think about our programs. Tell us which program or programs you like the best. And if you have any message for our great listeners around the world, you can record your voice, send it to us, and get your voice heard in this program. As I always say, Listeners Special is your program. It's your views that are important. Please keep us company until the end of the program. This is Listeners Special, and here, as usual, we've received reception reports from you from around the world, from Ivan Zeleny from Russia, from Arto Toisi from Finland, and again from Finland, from Johannes Lamy. So, Ivan, Arto, and Johannes, thank you for your support and commitment to IRIB English Radio, and you have sent us piles of letters and emails from around the world, which I mentioned some of your names here. And later during the program, I will read these emails. Johannes Lamy from Finland has sent us a piece of email. Toshio Shibata from Japan has sent us an email. Ratan Kumar Paul, one of our old and regular listeners from India, has sent us a message, and from Canada we've received an email from Alan Willey, one of our regular listeners, and Siddhartha Bhattacharji from India has sent us a piece of email. Stay with us, please. I will be back with you. So let's see what Siddhartha Bhattacharji, one of our old and regular listeners from India, says. Siddhartha says, "Dear staff, here I submit audio file of your broadcast. Hope it will be a great help for you and your technicians. Kindly send me your program schedule, sticker stamps, and other promotional material, which is available in order to represent your radio here in India. First of all, salam and warm greetings to you from Tehran, the capital of the Islamic Republic of Iran. Siddhartha Bhattacharji from India, we are so grateful to you for this message. The audio file has been received and, of course, appreciated. It was a great help to us, and such things, as you may know, helps us improve the quality of our programs. Siddhartha Bhattacharji from India, write to us soon and tell us your views about our programs, and please accept our electronic QSL as confirmation to your email. From Japan, we've received an email from Toshio Shibata, one of our regular listeners. Toshio says, "Dear staff, I received IRIB broadcast of medium wave here in Japan. On SW, there are not many transmitter sites in each country, but in MW, there are many. Thanks again for being in touch with me. Best regards." Salam from Tehran, the capital of the beautiful Iran. Toshio Shibata from Japan, thank you very much for sending this email to IRIB English Radio and Listeners Special Program. Let me inform you that you will be receiving an electronic QSL or EQSL from IRIB English Radio as confirmation to this email. Write to us soon and tell us your views about our programs. After a short break, dear listeners, I will be back with you. Welcome back. It's Listeners Special, and let's see what our listener from Finland says. Johannes Lummi says, "Dear IRIB English Radio staff, I hope you are doing well. I'm Johannes Lummi. I am 17-year-old and I live in Finland. Last time I wrote to you some week ago, I hope the letter has reached you. I have enclosed the postcard to my letter. The postcard shows the Tower of Olympic Stadium in our capital, Helsinki. I would love to receive a confirmation card from you. First of all, salam and warm greetings to you, and I do thank you for this message, Johannes Lummi from Finland. We also hope that you are doing well. We received the postcard with the picture of Olympic Stadium in the capital, Helsinki, and it was beautiful. Thank you for it. Please accept our electronic QSL or EQSL as confirmation to this email, Johannes, and write to us soon and tell us your views about our programs. Tell us which program or programs you like the best. Thank you, Johannes Lummi from Finland. And from India, we have an email from Ratan Kumar Paul, one of our old and regular listeners. Ratan says, "Greetings from India. Please verify my reception with your QSL card and send some postal stamps of Iran and other countries. Stamps collection is my second hobby. I am a regular listener of your radio. Thanks for this nice and informative program." Salam and warmest greetings to you, Ratan Kumar Paul from India, and thank you very much for your support and commitment to IRIB English Radio and Listeners Special. It's good to hear that you like this program and you find it nice and informative. Anyway, as soon as we could be able to send you and all our listeners the materials like the promotional items and souvenirs of IRIB English Radio, we will soon do it. At the time being, please accept our EQSL as confirmation to your email. Thank you, Ratan Kumar Pal from India. And after a short break, I will be back with you. Regular listener Alan Willie from Canada has sent us a piece of email. Alan says, "Dear staff, once again, greetings from Newfoundland, Canada. I have sent you few reception reports of IRIB shortwave broadcast as monitored here in Canada. Hope they will be verified from your side. Good wishes and thank you for the hard work. Salam and greetings to you, Alan Willie from Canada. And I do appreciate you for sending this message to IRIB English Radio and listeners a special program. Our appreciations to you also for the reception reports, Alan. We wish you all the best and we are looking forward to hearing from you very soon and hearing your views about our broadcast." Dear listeners, again, I do extend my deepest condolences to you on the arrival of the month of Muharram, the month of the martyrdom of the Master of Martyrs, Imam Hussein, peace upon him. But before saying goodbye to you, I do send my warm greetings and appreciations to those of you who have kindly sent us reception reports as well as emails and letters and messages from around the world, including Ivan Zeleny from Russia, Arto Toisi from Finland, Johannes Lamy from Finland, Siddhartha Bhattacharji from India, Toshio Shibata from Japan, Ratan Kumar Pal from India, and Alan Willey from Canada. Please keep in touch with us, with IRIB English Radio, and with the program Listeners Special. We wish you all the best. God bless you and goodbye.
Dear listeners, your opinion is always important to us. We invite you to spend just a few minutes writing us a letter or sending us an email. We will be glad to hear from all of our listeners who have any questions or comments about any of our programs. Our postal address is IRIB English Service, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran. You can also send us emails to englishradio@irib.ir. Please visit our website at parstoday.ir/en. Our phone number is 0098-21-2201-3720. Thank you all for being with IRIB English Radio.
Bring us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
The war in Ukraine is raging on. Ukraine is using U.S. cluster munitions for the first time. Although it's too early to assess its success, this is not seen as a game changer. Meanwhile, Russia has been bombing Ukraine relentlessly, hitting food supply centers. Why isn't Russia winning the war? And why is Ukraine being provided with military assets, which amount to only making moderate gains? The EU has also made a major announcement that it will provide Ukraine with 22 billion euros for the next 5 years, which risks prolonging the war. First, let me introduce our guest for this edition of the program. Edward Lozansky, president of the World Russia Forum, joins us from Washington, D.C. And Daniel Kovalik, professor of international human rights at the University of Pittsburgh School of Law, joins us from Pittsburgh, PA. Welcome to you both. Edward Lozansky, let me first start with you, if I may. Let's go on to the first, alarming use of weapons called cluster munitions that the U.S. has provided Ukraine. And we understand that they are now being used on the battlefield. Of course, we need to also say that Ukraine has accused Russia of using the same type of munitions. What is the success rate of these cluster munitions that Ukraine is using? Correct me if I'm wrong, it's just, contributes to some killings on the battlefield, but not much more than that, if I'm correct to look at it that way.
Well, not just on the battlefield. It kills civilians. And today, actually, it killed a Russian reporter and injured four. But you're right, it's not really a game changer. It simply continues and suffering for Ukrainians and for Russians. The reason why I think, at least how the Washington explains, that they really are running out of regular ammunition, and then the only thing left is those cluster bombs, which is a kind of a violation of international law. But who cares? International law, was violated already many times. In the Middle East, of course. In Iraq and Syria, Libya, and other wars. So it's sad. It's a sad story because the only thing that could avoid this war from the beginning, it was if Ukraine would have a neutral status. It was so simple because if Ukraine will accept this neutral status, then it will benefit. It can be friends with the West, with the United States, Europe, all over the world, including Russia, which is, has strong ties. They live together like over three centuries. So, it's the West, now it's called collective West, decides that instead of allowing Ukraine, which most of the Ukrainian people wanted this neutral, majority of Ukrainians wanted this neutral status, but they were not allowed, but the elites,
A majority of Ukrainians wanted what? I didn't catch that. I'm sorry.
They wanted to have neutral status. They didn't want to join NATO. When all opinion polls before 2014, they were saying that majority of Ukrainians don't want to join NATO. That's why there was a coup, and the coup which brought a new government, which declared that they want to join NATO. And
sure.
This is the reason for the war.
All right. We'll expand on that a little bit later, hopefully. I'd like to just find out from you, Daniel Kovalik, the use of cluster munitions. You have at this point, as our guests there indicated, a Russian war reporter was killed, four were wounded, which was basically through the use of these U.S.-provided cluster munitions. When it comes to the point of whether this was provided because Ukraine had no ammo, it really puts sheds another light onto this whole scenario. If it doesn't have ammo, why is it being provided with cluster munitions? And the mere fact that there's a shortage of ammo, what does that say about the war and the support that it's getting?
Well, President Biden made it clear that the cluster munitions were being sent as a stopgap measure because the U.S. had run out of other munitions. So, yes, NATO is running out of munitions. I mean, that's why Ukraine's running out of munitions, right? It says a lot. It says that Russia is burning through the West's military supply, which is pretty profound. Meanwhile, Russia seems to be able to keep up with, you know, producing its own munitions. So it certainly means that Ukraine and the West are losing this war, but the West is doing anything it can to keep the war continuing, to keep it prolonged in order to try to damage Russia. And so, yeah, now Biden's even resorted to sending these cluster munitions, even though Obama had decided to stop, you know, providing countries with those because of international law concerns. But, you know, as our colleague said, who cares? I mean, sadly, liberals in the U.S. who used to care about these things don't care about these things anymore, don't care about war and peace, don't care about cluster bombs, don't care about the possibility of nuclear war. So this thing continues to escalate. And the use of these weapons is definitely an escalation of the conflict. And the fact they're being used in mainland Russia, you know, in Belgorod against Russians, is quite significant. You know, the problem with cluster munitions, amongst many others, is that a significant percentage of them do not go off immediately, which means they just sit somewhere. And someone years from now will come along, maybe a child, and hit it and be killed or maimed. And, you know, that's what makes it really an indiscriminate military device and what makes it in violation of international humanitarian law.
Okay. There's been a lot of speculation, which I'd like to find out from you whether what you think is the case, and that is how Russia is targeting these food storage facilities of Ukraine. One scenario that is being put out there is the fact that Russia wants to use food as a weapon of war, and this is its way of doing it. It stopped, you know, the supply, as we're well aware of that. Edward Lozansky, what is Russia's goal there? Do you think that it's using food as a weapon of war?
Well, first of all, as far as I know, Russia is not bombing those food supplies, storage. It's bombing the infrastructure of the ports in Odessa and other cities. Not direct hit of the grain. In terms of using grain as a weapon, or food as a weapon, it's not so, because Russia is ready to provide this food even for free, some, not all, but for example, some fertilizers to poor stations, poor nations. It's willing to provide it for free, it's ready to do it. But the thing is that it's under sanctions. And the deal which was made with the help of the United Nations, that as long as these food supplies through Black Sea will go on, some sanctions for Russian food supplies will be lifted, which didn't happen. Also, it was Ukraine used those some of the tankers to ship weapons. Actually, one of the tankers was used to now inflict damage on the Crimean bridge. So this is what Kremlin and Putin are saying, that Russia is ready to provide this grain, Ukraine can do the same as long as the deal which was made with the help of the nations is honored. But the deal was not honored.
Okay, thank you so much for clarifying the fact that it was the infrastructure that was targeted and not the facility itself. Well, let's take a look at something that may be a game changer. And it's still such a perplexing notion of the U.S. perspective, I should say, Daniel Kovalik, as to the way that they've been providing arms and military assets to Ukraine. There was a very worrying piece of news that came from National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan, and it read as follows. White House's Sullivan, whether or not we give ATACMs to Ukraine is a decision to be made by the president. Now, these are tactical ballistic missiles that's manufactured by Lockheed Martin. Could this be a game changer? Because these are long-range missiles, and, of course, we know what that means. And if it is something that's being contemplated and the U.S. president is going to say yes or no to it, of which he has said yes now to almost everything, I think at this point the F-16s or the fighter jets and this ATACMs are left. What do you think would happen? Is that a prelude to World War III?
It certainly could be, yeah. I mean, we could be looking at some sort of major conflagration in Europe, and yeah, possibly an exchange of nuclear weapons. This is a very dangerous move. Biden knows that, by the way. He's mentioned in the past, if you send those types of weapons, that's World War III, right? And he wouldn't do it. Well, now he's decided he keeps changing his own red lines. He keeps moving them all forward or backward, however you look at it, and removing those red lines and deciding to send weapons he formerly said would cause World War III, and he doesn't seem to care about that now. You know, he seems to be willing to do anything to prolong this war in order to, one, weaken Russia, and two, let's face it, to try to win the 2024 election that's quickly approaching. I think he's made the calculus that if Russia wins this war before the election, that he'll lose, and he's willing to keep it going to try to win, and he's willing to keep it going even if it means nuclear war. And I can't think of a more reprehensible decision to make.
Admiral Lisansky, we have heard so much about the gains and losses on the battlefield. On the one hand, let me ask you about what Putin has said, and he has said this a number of occasions, that Ukraine has lost tens of thousands of soldiers. First of all, my question to you is, if Ukraine is losing so badly, why isn't Russia defeating Ukraine?
I think that Russia is using only limited resources, because Putin and actually a majority of Russians feel that Ukrainians are our people. We are the same. We lived together for over three centuries. We have our not just economy and joint and culture, religion, by the way, which is very important. Both countries, majority are Orthodox, Slavic Orthodox, and families. So a lot of families are mixed with Russian and Ukrainian spouses. So I think this is all taken into account. The Russians feel that they just cannot use all this enormous force that they have to kill their own. So it's a sad story that the Russians, Ukrainians are killing each other. But I think in one of my kind of articles, actually in American media, I printed out that what's going on now is worse than Vietnam and Iraq and the other wars in the Middle East, because over there, American soldiers were fighting and dying. But now Ukraine is used like a mercenary country. The whole country became a country of mercenaries. And they're fighting war, not their war. They're fighting war for the United States, for the collective West, which wants to defeat and impose a strategic defeat for Russia. So I'm really sorry for my fellow Ukrainians. I myself was born in Ukraine, and I have a lot of relatives and friends in Ukraine. And now my fellow Ukrainians are used as cannon fodder. It's horrible.
Well, I'm trying to figure out the strategy that Ukraine has, Daniel Kovalik. I'm not a military strategist. Maybe I can get help from you. When you take a look at the way that Ukraine is fighting, it seems like they're just warding off or they're repelling the attacks by Russia. And that's the best case scenario. Advances are so minimal. Even not only has Ukraine said that, President Zelensky, but also the U.S., a variety of officials have come forward saying that the gains on the ground are very minimal, if any. So, what's the use of this war if it's just to repel or to stand up to Russia, but not to win the war and to beat Russia?
Well, Ukraine does not have a strategy, and it certainly doesn't have a strategy of its own. You know, the U.S. is calling the shots on this. And the U.S., its goal is to prolong the war, not necessarily to win it. They want to prolong it in order to weaken Russia in the same way that Afghanistan was used in the 80s to weaken the Soviet Union. They want to try to use this war to drain Russia economically and militarily, to try to destabilize Russia. And so Ukraine is just being used as a tool for that. Their soldiers are just being used as fodder for this, because that's what the U.S. wants. And the Ukrainian leadership does not have the interest of Ukraine or the Ukrainian people at heart. They are simply using this war to line their own pockets. We know from the CIA that, when this is from a few months ago, that even by that time, Zelensky's folks had stolen about $400 million, it was at least, from the aid being sent to Ukraine. You know, Zelensky and his people, their goal is to do whatever the U.S. wants. And then when this is over, their hope is that they'll move to Miami or the Bahamas with billions of dollars and be happy. The fact they leave their country in ruins and their country people dead seems of no consequence to them.
Yeah, we could talk about the corruption. As you mentioned, it did come out in the news a few months ago. And Ukraine is categorized to be a very corrupt country. But unfortunately, we have a few other more important pieces of facts here that we need to discuss. Edward Luzhansky, this plan that has been drawn up by the EU, which has raised a lot of eyebrows as to what is behind it, and that's the $22 billion, as Joseph Borrell called, a weapons fund to provide Ukraine with weapons and military aid over the course of 4 years. What do you make of it? I mean, on the one hand, some are saying this will prolong the war. On the other hand, is what that security guarantee that Zelensky was looking for. What do you think it is?
Well, EU leadership, it's not just aboard vessels. It's using oil more and more often. I recall that in 2007, when Putin spoke to the Munich Security Conference, he first used this word. He said, we want to be American friends, and even allies. America doesn't need friends. America needs only vassals. So Europe, EU, this is now a country of vassals. They keep giving this money to Ukraine when their own people are suffering. Look at what's going on in Britain now with all the strikes and underpaid medical personnel and what was happening in France and in other countries. So they betrayed their own people. So this is horrible. And talking about corruption, it's not just only corruption in Ukraine, it's corruption in Washington. What's going on now, when more and more facts, whistleblowers are coming out and saying that President Biden is corrupt, that he was using Ukraine as a moneymaker. He installed his son on this corrupt company, Burisma, and Burisma paid him bribes. And this is open, it's in Congress. So can you imagine? They keep talking about values, democracy, freedom, that their own president is corrupt and he probably has to be impeached.
What do you think about that, Kovalik?
I agree. I think Biden should be impeached. I think he is waging a war in part to cover his own corruption, which is, again, horrifying, absolutely horrifying. And sadly, the U.S. press has covered up this corruption, but as my colleague has said, the truth is coming out, as it always will. But for a president to use a war to deal with his own individual corruption is something that should never happen. He has betrayed the American people. He has betrayed the Ukrainian people in doing this. He is risking a nuclear war, again, to deal with his own personal misdeeds. I can't think of a worse thing to do. I can't think of a worse president, to be honest. I hope the American people wake up in time to stop this.
If I can add to what just
Nick said,
the guy with the name Kennedy, he keeps saying exactly the same what we are saying. Kennedy is Democrat. No, he is son of Robert Kennedy, who was killed, and the nephew of John Kennedy. He's saying exactly that. He's saying that Biden is pushing us to nuclear war, and Tulsi Gabbard, she was also running for president from the Democratic Party. She says, exactly. So even Democrats are turning against Biden. I think he has to be impeached as soon as possible, and maybe a new president will stop this horror.
All right. My final question goes to you, Daniel Kovalik. We talked about the long-range missiles. We talked about one thing we didn't talk about is how there were 3,000 more U.S., Marines, I believe, or soldiers were sent, 3,000 troops, reservists, were sent to Europe, which puts the number at over 100,000, which is for the first time since the year 2005. Given all that, are we looking at a more or a thought behind these actions that the U.S. may be thinking of upping the ante in terms of a direct conflict with Russia through NATO, maybe?
I mean, absolutely. I think there are people in Washington who want that, who believe they had hoped, let's face it, they hoped that the economic sanctions against Russia would have weakened, if not destroyed, Russia. It did not. Russia's doing fine. They had prepared for those sanctions. The war is not destroying Russia. So now I think there are people who feel like NATO has to be more directly involved to defeat Russia. And that's the name of the game here. And yes, I do think the sending of these troops is a sign that there is a move in that direction to have a direct confrontation with Russia. And again, this should be horrifying to anyone in the world, certainly to Americans, who need to hold their government accountable for this.
Thank you very much for that. Daniel Kovalik, Professor of International Human Rights, University of Pittsburgh School of Law from Pittsburgh, PA. Edward Lesnowski, thank you. President of the World Russia Forum from Washington, D.C. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikhail Tagway and the team, it's goodbye.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellite. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 25 meters, 11,645 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Iran Sat or Bat 5 and Intel Sat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.